You're listening to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Lexington podcast. Take a moment to center yourself in this space and enjoy this week's sermon.
Today's reading is the poem Accepting This by Mark Nepo. Yes, it's true. I confess. I have thought great thoughts and sung great songs, all of it rehearsal for the majesty of being held. The dream is awakened when thinking, I love you, and life begins when saying, I love you, and joy moves like blood when embracing others with love. My efforts now turn from trying to outrun suffering to accepting love wherever I can find it. Stripped of causes and plans and things to strive for, I have discovered everything I could need or ask for is right here in flawed abundance. We cannot eliminate hunger, but we can feed each other. We cannot eliminate loneliness, but we can hold each other. We cannot eliminate pain, but we can live a life of compassion. Ultimately, we are small living things awakened in the streams, not gods who carve out rivers. Like human fish, we are asked to experience meaning in the life that moves through the gill of our heart. There is nothing to do and nowhere to go. Accepting this, we can do everything and go anywhere. Again, that's Accepting This by poet Mark Nepo.
We'll take a moment to thank Martin Herbner and Steve Swart today for being our guest musicians while so much. Let's go ahead and imagine something this morning. It's nothing out of the ordinary, really. It's not exceptional. It takes place in a church. It's happening right now all across the world. Yes, right here in Lexington as well. The type of church is decidedly Christian. You can have your pick. Megachurch, Evangelical, Southern Baptist, Apostolic, Lutheran congregations, so on and so forth. There's a lot of them. The practices and methods differ among them. Yes, even the beliefs differ. There's not one single Christianity to experience. For our purposes this morning, it doesn't really matter. Like so many faith communities in the history of this nation, the church we're imagining wonders about diversity. It worries about finances. It juggles a million different ideas and tasks and things breaking every single week, and it moves at the pace of church. The songs sung are sometimes familiar or brand new to the attendees, and each week a familiar story is told in these churches, or this one church we're imagining. That is the Christian story, the story of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, the church we're imagining might be what you call a purple church. It's not super blue liberal or super red conservative. It's a mix. Probably just right of center. At least that's what denominational profiles tell us, if you're mainline or evangelical. The pastor is a respected educator and leader in their denomination. Now go ahead and imagine whatever you want the music to be. The rituals, the prayers, is it praise music? Hands in the air! Our God is an awesome God, over and over again. Or is it traditional hymns? A mix of old and new. Is the praying silent, contemplative? Do people burst out in spontaneous praise or speak tongues? Is there dancing in the aisles? You can fill in the blanks however you like. But then comes time for the sermon. You can imagine that however you like too. Does the pastor pace around the stage wearing jeans and a plaid shirt or turtleneck, a blouse and slacks? Using PowerPoint slides? Is the pastor traditionally dressed? Maybe even with a robe and a stole, a suit, or a dress? Is there a mix of both? Imagine whatever you like, but all discernment happens. The scripture for this month in this imaginary church is Matthew chapters 5 to 7, also known as the Sermon on the Mount. Today they're focusing on the first 11 verses, Beatitudes. Who remembers the Beatitudes? Or has a familiarity with them? They go like this. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountain. After he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are those who are meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." The pastor goes on to preach about how these Beatitudes can be applied to our lives, and so on and so forth. The collection is taken, you know how it goes, right? The service ends in song, the people leave and start to greet the pastor as they move into fellowship hour, but something interesting now starts to happen. At first, it's an odd comment to the pastor. Then it starts coming from some of the elders, the board members, and other leaders. One person is absolutely incensed by the sermon, almost shouting loudly, "Why are you bringing these woke liberal ideas into our congregation?" The pastor replies, "Those were the words of Jesus. I'm quoting Jesus." The parishioner replies, "That doesn't work anymore. That's weak." Maybe this was a one-off thing, but no, the controversy continues in this imaginary church. The pastor is relieved of all their denominational duties. They're brought up for review before the church board and their denominational review panel. They're ultimately dismissed as the pastor of the church for being too political and not fulfilling their obligations. In 2021, this exact story happened to Pastor Russell Moore, a Southern Baptist minister who dared to preach the Sermon on the Mount, critique the presidency of Donald Trump, and criticize the Southern Baptist Convention for its handling of its own sex abuse crisis. But Pastor Moore will be the first to tell you that he's not special. You don't need to look far to see ministers and priests and pastors being dismissed or run out of a church for preaching and teaching the words of Jesus of Nazareth, especially those found in the Sermon on the Mount. The words that tell us to love our neighbors, the words that tell us that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, the words that focus on helping the widow, the orphan, and the poor. Now, Russell Moore says there's a crisis in American Christianity, a crisis where the words of their own prophet, and in so many of those traditions, right, not just a prophet, but an incarnate deity, are disputed or outright rejected. And ministers like Moore are losing their jobs or leaving the profession. From publications such as Christian Century or Christianity Today, news outlets like NPR or the New York Times, to groups such as ex-pastors, yes, that's a real group, ex-pastors, that provide support for the waves of clergy quitting, roughly 1,700 a month. If it keeps at that pace in 22 years, there'll be no more clergy. There's a lot of us. It's not hard to find stories where our political and cultural divide are driving people away from, in this instance, the Christian ministry. Now, before we think Unitarian Universalists are safe, no, we're not. We may not have the intensity of a right-left divide, but we still have other forces that are driving away clergy in droves. We have one of the most significant minister shortages in the history of our movement. But let me clarify that. We have plenty of ministers. None of them want to be in the parish anymore. That's another sermon for another day. The story of Russell Moore can take place in nearly any church up and down Claysmill Road this morning. It could happen just up the street, just across town. It could happen across Kentucky or across our country. It could happen anywhere from an Episcopalian parish where it has happened, where they tend to be theologically progressive, to any of the flavors of Baptist right here in town, across the theological spectrum. Now, I don't want to suggest our job here this morning is to figure out this problem for Christianity, because it isn't. And I don't think it's possible to fully understand it yet. But what remains is both an interesting and heartbreaking problem. In a religion where the heart of it, the Sermon on the Mount, is rejected, what's really happening here? Gandhi once said that if everything about Christianity were to suddenly disappear overnight, with the exception of the Sermon on the Mount, the heart of Christianity would survive. So what's at stake here? What are we looking at? What does this have to do with us as the Unitarian Universalists? What's the core problem here? In short, and you've heard it enough from me, you keep hearing it, we're living in a hypercharged, stressed, anxious world system where lines are drawn, toxic tribalism is reinforced, and our capacity to hold complexity is diminished. And suddenly the question of who is my neighbor, which is a fundamental question in Christianity and nearly every other world religion, in some way gets divisive, heated, charged. We can test it out right now. Who is my neighbor? To that I could say, my neighbor is the Hamas militant and the Israeli soldier. I don't know, but you can almost feel some of the air leave the room. Right? I felt my blood pressure rising because I expect pushback on that. My neighbors, everyone who's suffering greatly in Israel and Palestine right now. My neighbors are the masses at the border, the waves of people crossing that border, risking their lives looking for a better life. The masses being deported, and yes, the immigration agents too. My neighbors are the people in the MAGA hats and the ones with Black Lives Matter signs in the front yards. My neighbors, the poor, and the 1% of the 1%. And we can keep going like this all day long. It's an expansive view, and it's meant to challenge us, to make us uncomfortable. For Jesus of Nazareth, during the time that he preached the Sermon on the Mount, to say you should love your neighbor was a radical act. The word Jesus used in the Greek, as it was translated to the Greek, often just meant your fellow Hebrews only. The word for neighbor. But Jesus also used it to talk about Samaritans, Romans, people who were not Hebrew, those who were deemed unclean and not permitted into the temple, prostitutes, tax collectors, who were seen as people colluding with the empire. This was a time when your literal neighbors were nations that conquered you, or you conquered in return and back and forth. Generations of blood spilt between you and your neighbors, and oppression and violence and hatred. Read the Hebrew Bible and you see it everywhere. Other gods and nations being denounced, or the suffering of the Hebrew people being declared a just punishment, and so on and so forth. So to say yes, they too are my neighbors, and the unclean, and the poor, and the outcast, and the person who is not of my tribe, at such a time in history, it was revolutionary and dangerous. Dangerous to defy such cultural understandings, dangerous to defy an oppressive empire. So Gustavo Gutierrez, who's a Peruvian theologian and Dominican priest, and he's one of the primary thinkers and founders of what's called liberation theology, answers the question, who is my neighbor, in this way. He says, being a neighbor and asking who is your neighbor is less about that being a noun. It's more about it being a verb, an action. He writes, if I define my neighbor as the one I must go out to look for on the highways and byways and the factories and slums and on the farms and in the mines, then my world changes. Kind of changes the whole conversation, doesn't it? That lines up with what we hear on the Sermon on the Mount, expanding our understanding of neighbor. Gutierrez's book, A Theology of Liberation, published in the early 70s, makes some incredible claims. whether or not you believe the theology that's in there. He says flat out that God has a preference for the poor. In other words, God is with them in their struggle more than the privileged. Now, critical minds would say, well, what does that say about God? Well, we should ask that too. But in the context of that Gutierrez was writing this, the struggles of Latin America, the influence and interference of the United States and their economies and government, and the struggles of the people, you can understand why he would write that. It's a rallying cry for the oppressed. And it's rooted in this understanding of who is my neighbor. Gutierrez continues that we really have no neighbors until we make it active. Until we get close to someone. Which makes everything I said earlier about who my neighbor is just a conceptual exercise. Happy, nice words. Yes, my neighbors are across the oceans. Yes, both sides of the Israel-Hamas war are my neighbors. Yes, both sides of Ukraine and Russia. But then I need to ask myself, have I gotten close to anyone impacted by this? Have I gotten close to anyone impacted by the Russian invasion on Ukraine? Have I gotten close to people right here in our community who believe radically different than I do, who I would prefer to ignore and pass by on the street? All of this is asking us to be pretty vulnerable here. It's so much easier just to conceptualize our neighbors. And with these bigger events, the great suffering in Israel, Palestine, Ukraine, yes, Russia too, elsewhere in the world, and even across town, there are limits to how much suffering that human beings can hold. Complex suffering. And that's not a call to dismiss all of this, but it might just be another piece of what we're facing as a world, a hyper-connected world. Maybe, just maybe, many of us have a great deal of compassion fatigue, information overload. And maybe the way our world operates just makes it easier to conceptualize everything instead of getting close. I liked something on social media, I did my part. I don't promise any answers here. I almost never do. I'm working on it with all of you. And it's going to be messy. Dr. Barbara Holmes, who is a scholar of African-American theology and a liberation theologian, talks about this mess quite a bit. She dives deep into concepts that resonate specifically with African-American and other oppressed communities in our culture. And one of the concepts she talks about often in her book, Race and the Cosmos, which happens to be the most wild and wonderful theology book ever, is the beloved community. We talk about Dr. King so often, the concept that resonates still to this day. She pushes back against the notion that beloved community is neat and tidy and perfect. She points out and writes, as it turns out, the community called beloved has its discomforts and foibles. Community is not just a love fest. It is also a site of tension. Now, this is why I really enjoy liberation theology. There's no promise of perfection ever. But there is a promise of messiness and glimpses of it all coming together toward some measure of liberation and joy and hope. Both of Gutierrez and Holmes, you have people from deeply oppressed communities and contexts saying, wait a minute, there is a way. There's always a way. Asking who our neighbor is and turning that into an action, the very act of getting close to those who could become our neighbors, has no promise to fix or cure anything, other than nudging us toward a world that increasingly seeks liberation and favors community over isolation. That's still messy. But that's where we're called. What happened to Pastor Russell Moore when he preached the words of Jesus of Nazareth and was kicked out of his profession and his faith is a symptom of a larger problem. Now, I know I say we can't fix it on our own a lot. That's not to remind us we're powerless. Don't get to feel that way. But to remind us the way through isn't in increasing the divides between us, but in getting close to our neighbors here and elsewhere. And then I just say all of this, and then I look at my own life, and I realize how much work I have to do. I make a million judgments about the world and other people a day. And sometimes all I need to do is get closer, to be the one to bridge the divide, in the hopes that someone will bridge the divide with me too. And even then, it's complex. Should I get close to the neighbor who wants to deprive me of my livelihood, my marriage, and more? Should anyone have their rights threatened and be forced to do this? Absolutely not. But that's when we come back to community, the mess of community, where we begin answering the question of who is my neighbor right here. And we start small, start local. With everything flying by us, right in our pockets, on our phones right now, you can have access to international news and every single event that's happening across the globe and every single piece of suffering. Of course we want to focus on what's happening across the oceans. But start here. The world will always be waiting. The work of the world is as common as mud, says the poet Marge Piercy. But there is hope and glimpses of the community called Beloved available to us. If only we try. If only we remember what's at our core. If only. If only. Blessed be, dear friends. Amen.
Amen.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. If you would like to learn more about us, please visit our website at www.ucl.org, where you can find more information about our grounds, staff, and upcoming events. You can also subscribe to our e-news there and learn about our virtual service offerings. We'll see you next week.